Welcome to the Good Dog Pod. Join us every other Wednesday when we discuss all things dogs, from health and veterinary care to training and behavior science, as well as the ins and outs of Good Dog and how our platform can help you successfully run your breeding program. Follow us and join Good Dog's mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them. So I just want to formally welcome everyone to our webinar today, which is Genetic Hygiene and Long-Term Maintenance of Lines with our guest, Dr. Victor J. Stora, who's joined us for a few webinars already this year. We're excited to have him back. Today, he's going to teach us all about maintaining healthy, sustainable breeding lines across multiple generations. Together, we're going to learn about genetic hygiene, including inherited disease risk, genetic diversity, coefficient of inbreeding, which we've covered a lot already this year, selection pressure, and long-term breed preservation that can help you as breeders make ethical and evidence-based decisions that protect the future of your lines. So we're really excited to get into the presentation today. I will just quickly share a little bit about Dr. Stora for anyone who hasn't joined our webinars with him before, and then I will pass things over to him for our presentation. Dr. Stora graduated from LSU School of Veterinary Medicine and then completed an internship in small animal medicine at Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine. He went on to a residency in reproduction, medical genetics, and pediatrics at Ryan Veterinary Hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. That was sponsored by the American Kennel Club, AKC Canine Health Foundation, and the Theriogenology Foundation. Dr. Stora specializes in canine genetic counseling and andrology and has special interests in canine and feline internal medicine, critical care, dermatology, and behavior. Dr. Stora is also a diplomat of the American College of Theriogenology and a member of the American Veterinary Medical Association, Society for Theriogenology, and American Society for Andrology. And he is also a longtime breeder of Shetland sheepdogs under the House Astoria kennel name, which is a very fun fact about you. So with that, Dr. Stora, I will let you kick off the presentation.
Okay. So I kind of formatted this to be like a little bit about the like boring stuff, I guess, and then a section on what I kind of do in my kennel and look for, and then more like Q&A area, because I think that with this, it's a lot of questions about like with, you know, my breed or my line, like how do I maintain everything going forward. So again, I kind of want to just run through the basics, like to understand like basic of genetic testing, a lot of the maintenance of lines and the maintenance of our kennels has to do with health. So they're hand in hand. Also preservation of traits that we want that comes with it. So we're trying to figure out how to kind of navigate both avenues at the same time. So we want to understand genetic testing and how we can apply it in a breeding program, understand how breeding traditions tend to limit our genetic variance and increase disease or risk, understand how decreased variance leads to disease states, and then what I look for in breeding pairs and setting goals for my kennel in general. We talked about that at first. I do breed Shetland sheepdogs. I've been doing that for a very long time now. So it gives me a perspective as what we're both looking for in health and for preserving our lines. So with hereditary disorders, we see more of that in purebred animals just because we're decreasing their overall variance and what we term, we're increasing their homozygosity, which means that they're more uniform. So it means that we are selecting for a certain trait or we're line breeding or you are using individuals that are more related. So their genome or their genetics are becoming more uniform in the background. They're becoming more similar. So everyone walks around with the areas of their DNA that are deleterious or otherwise would cause disease. But since we have other copies, then we don't really see the disease because it has a secondary pairing that masks it. And when you start to breed more individuals that are related, the chances of you inheriting that area that is mutated or deleterious on two sides and then therefore not having a functional gene is much higher. When we select for things, phenotypic traits or traits that we want in a certain breed, or even if it's personality or their disposition, you don't really know if you're intentionally or unintentionally selecting for a disease state because they could be linked or near each other on the chromosome. It's, are they physically close to each other as a gene? And then as we go to extremes, do the extreme states cause disease because of the way that they're anatomically changing the anatomy so much? When we talk about decreases of genetic diversity or genetic variance, we have popular sire effect, bottlenecks, founder effect, and selection pressures. I talk about popular sire effect the most because that's usually the one that happens the most often. Popular sire effect is taking the same sire and using him over and over again to the way there's too many related individuals amongst kennels and in your kennel that everyone is too related. So it's hard to breed away from him should there be a problem that we note. Bottlenecks are when events happen that overall just significantly limit the genetic stock. So let's say a disease happens like COVID, you know, there's a large population that is affected and otherwise, unfortunately, dies off. And then the rest of the population is left. In dogs, if that happens, if there is a bottleneck, then you lose a lot of genetic diversity, which we're already kind of have very limited amount of it. Founder effect is kind of something you can't help because it's just when the breed is founded, how many of individuals are participating in that foundation. And if there's not many, then you're limiting how many genes were allowed in there to begin with. We're pushing for a certain phenotype or a certain look in the dog or, you know, a certain kind of outline. And it's pushed more and more to be like that. So we have this push for that. We're getting more towards a disease state or we're selecting for diseases as well. So as I talked about, popular sire effect is the overuse of a particular sire. Not that you shouldn't use that. It's something that you should use a certain sire if they are showing, you know, a specific type of virtue, but overusing them and making 100% of your kennel related to where you can't then get out. Or if your kennel has a 50% relation to him and you go to breed with other kennels and they also have 50%, it just becomes difficult to breed away from a certain dog. You know, there are diseases that can happen. You can't see them because there's a functional copy and then there's a misfunctioning copy and it's just masking it. It's not the dog's reputation. It's just biology. And so if you're breeding too much, too close to this, then you're breeding too close to potentially having that deleterious allele or gene pop back up and then cause disease. And it's hard to kind of breed away from that if everyone is really closely related to him as well. This just goes through like what happens when you don't see it. It's hard to see in generation one. So like this would be that stud dog that is really well used. He looks great. Like that's fine. You want to use him. That's great. It's just if everyone starts to use him and we breed that square that has like a half-half because half is a good gene and half is a bad gene to these four females, then we create a generation where we're not seeing any disease because we still have a functioning copy next to the black marked copy. So everyone is not showing any disease. Then we breed those again to males that are different or unrelated, but they are being bred to a lot of these carriers now that you can't see, but they are carriers of the disease. When we do that, we make another generation and the gene is still in the background, but not showing itself. And you're still watching what looks like good dogs. Like there's nothing wrong with them. And then in your third generation, everyone starts to see like a new disease come out or something different is happening. And then you're actually seeing the affected disease and you're now having to choose or go away from breeding in that line because it may become too difficult to get the diseases away from your line if it keeps happening over and over again when everyone is too related. So we can ship semen within the United States, just ship chilled. It doesn't matter where you are. That does lead to a ease of use with certain males in a high frequency that would otherwise have been limited by geographical areas before this. So then we look at health testing and we create the image of a standard and that's a goal that we want to achieve towards. And then we also have to play a role with this other thing with health testing and health in our purebred dogs because they do have a higher disease rate and there are known diseases for each breed. So we have both of these avenues we're trying to navigate together at the same time, which is tricky because it's not simple like math. It really is probability. and random events. It's not black and white at all. So in animal breeding, inbreeding is a commonly performed technique because we want to accentuate certain traits. So predictability. We know that this dog has this trait and this female, or this bitch has this trait. If we breed them together, we're likely to get similar generations of that particular trait we're going for. But again, there is a delicate balance that we must uphold because we don't want to tip the scales into either direction where it's basically where the trait is too accentuated and it may not be, you know, advisable, maybe against the health of the anatomically, but also you're decreasing your genetic diversity again, because you're choosing similar familial lines to breed through and you're going to potentially unmask disease. And you're also limiting the animal's overall homozygosity amongst its entirety so that potentially your fertility drops, or they may be weaker or not as robust as you are used to because they're more uniform. It's not healthy to be that way. So when we artificially select breeding pairs, there's no way I can say that there's no risk, even if it looks like both dogs have like perfectly clean bills of health. You know, there'll always be risk and there'll always be mutations. We just have to weigh the risks and the benefits. Again, it's probably a game of probability. Like, do the benefits outweigh the risks of this? Inbreeding, we kind of look at as related individuals. Contrast to this would be outcrossing individuals with no ancestral relations whatsoever. When we look at line breeding, it's considered more of a softer form of inbreeding, even though it still is inbreeding. When we use the term inbreeding, it refers mostly to incest, which is immediate familial relations like brother, sister, father, daughter matings. And now the problem with continuing that or going through homozygosity or making very uniform lines is that actually you start to lose fertility with that as well. And then you start to have higher mortalities earlier in life and higher mortalities of the progeny. So as you decrease the overall variation of an animal or your line, you're kind of getting worse and worse down this spiral of getting lower litter rates, higher mortalities in the litter, higher genetic diseases. And it just becomes difficult to actually get out of this spiral once you're in it too far, especially if your kennel is mostly one-sided or more heavily bred on this family line. You don't have different like existing lines. We have to look at, should every dog be tested for every disease that they may get? And I think that that's not really effective, because if we test for every DNA or health test known to a particular breed, it's overwhelming for both veterinarians and owners, and no one's going to be free of risk. So testing for the diseases that actually cause a problem, like they cause a significant problem, are the ones you have to prioritize. And then yes, the other ones should be looked at. But again, if a dog has a problem or has a potential to have is a carrier, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be bred. It means that you have now the knowledge of that and you should still use that dog and you should breed that dog, but knowing that it has a carrier state. So breeding it to an individual that is clear is the way to go. So it's to maintain using that dog, maintain the other useful genes that that dog has, but also breeding mindfully. So we have to weigh the benefits of health testing. So is this disease instance high enough to be warrant testing for? Are we actually seeing this or are we not? Is this disease testing recommended by the club's OFA or the breed club itself? Does the disease cause like significant morbidity and mortality? Meaning, is it really affecting the animal? Does it really hurt them to where the point where it is considered in a way cruel that they have this disorder, or does this disease lead rapidly to death? And then does this breeder have the disease of interest in their lines? Is it even there? Like, are you seeing it? Is there an effective treatment for this? So now we have to look at like how we figure out, how do we look at homozygosity? How do we look at our variants? Like, how do we get into that? And if a disease is known to plague a population and it's high, disease testing overrules the use of inbreeding and the coefficient to predict these diseases. But we need to have a way of determining how varied or how much variation our animals have so that we can kind of mindfully keep track of where we're going. Some of the problems we have is that dog that are tested by just looking at them, like eye exams and, you know, cardiac evaluations, looking or observing for traits, hip clearances. It's observation only. It's not looking at like the entire background of where they may be coming from. And some of it is the environment or how animals are raised. Some of it, there is not only the genetic part, but there is the part where how they grow up and how they're raised and if that actual disease will show and the severity of it, because, you know, environment does play an impact. When a marker or an allele is known and the disease is clearly defined, the use of the testing tool for breeding with knowledge and not throwing away individuals with a mutant type is beneficial. And that is the easiest to go by, is that we have a DNA test and they say normal, normal, or normal, clear. And that's easy. It's hard when you're looking at the animal and just using non-genetic tests or diagnostic tests that scale severity. It's not black and white, it's doctor dependent, or it's operator dependent on how bad something is. And breeding severe to mild or non-clear doesn't always yield like perfectly like medium results. It can still have severe disease. It's very hard to take these and breed them with a lot of caution. Most of the breed clubs have links to health testing on their website, and then they also have the most prominent diseases that you're looking for, where you're trying to identify which should I be testing for, which should I not be testing for, what's the most prominent right now, and which ones do I have in my line. These are, I think, valuable tools for breeds and breed clubs, depending on how on top of health testing is everybody, how much information is out there about what's going on in our lines. So again, we have like the phenotypic diagnosis with there's no known marker, there's no known DNA test for it, but there are ways we can just look with our tests and basically our eyes and try to figure out where we are. These are often polygenic traits, so the multiple genes are playing a role and or environment plays a role in them. And we have linked marker tests. We have tests that the disease gene is linked to another site that we can find, but the disease site we don't really know, but we know that it's associated with the GC tag. And then when there's the bad type, we know we can identify that by seeing that the marker in front of it is also different. But we can't actually see this, but we can see that this is there. Those are good. They allow for the suspicion of a disease state, but they're not definitive. Sometimes it can break away from the marker as time goes on. So it's always prudent to kind of keep track of, is that test being is valid, or is it actually not giving us the information that we want? Is it actually like missing cases? Mutation analysis is the breed specific result as normal, clear, carrier, or affected. It's probably the easiest one to use because it's very clear, you know, where you are. Is there a disease allele? Is there not? But it is also important to make sure that that test is correct or makes sense with what they report. Now, when we manage them, we can say that carriers and affected individuals can actually breed. If the disease doesn't cause the animal to have a very difficult life or any sort of issues that are causing a quality of life issue, they can actually breed with known normals. And you know that all the progeny will be carriers if it's an affected, or if a carrier breeds with a normal, then you'll have carrier states, but you can still use that animal. It's not like you're losing all of the variance that comes with that one as well. When we don't have a genetic test, you know, 9 of the top diseases from the AKC don't have a mutation-based test. There are different and multiple alleles. We have to just breed cautiously based on our phenotypic tests. We now have SNP chip arrays, which are basically large chips that have DNA sites that are on there, and the dog's DNA is plated on these little sites, and then the computer goes through like thousands of them, of these sites, and it starts to screen them, and it looks at known sites that cause disease, and it looks at known sites that, you know, we have genes for, and it looks at overall variance, like how varied is this genome compared to the population, or how homozygous is this compared to the population. So one of them is the Wisdom Panel, and they have optimal selection, which is the breed analysis that looks at their proprietary markers for evaluating genetic diversity. Again, these kits are pretty easy. They're simple at home swabs. They'll give you the breed information, and then it'll look at the disorders, traits, the diversity relationship, and then a breeder tool as well. So it'll give you the genotype and then also what other diseases that they find in there. If you go on the OFA check, there is also an area for where, you know, which diseases are prevalent in certain breeds and which ones we should be testing for or which ones are recommended per your breed. This is an example of the Shetland sheepdog. So we evaluate for hip dysplasia eye exams by an ophthalmologist. And then there are elective DNA-based tests, which honestly, if you do one of the arrays like the Embark or the Wisdom Panel, you'll get all of this. Basically, most of these DNA test ones you'll get. The other ones, again, are phenotypic tests. So those are based on an orthopedic surgeon or some third party that evaluates the test itself. You know, this looks at like overall how diverse the animal is. It's not just giving you your diseases. It's giving you how diverse overall the animal is and how it differs from the population. Anyone can perform this. It's kind of like 23andMe. Because we don't allow the addition of new dogs into certain breeds, it's like counseling and rehabilitating endangered species. Again, if your breed is very small, you want to kind of really try as hard as you can to preserve your standard, but also really, really hard move towards the higher variants, because each generation that you can pick that moves a little towards higher variants is going to get you healthier dogs later in your lines. It reports genetic diversity like this. It'll give you the inbreeding coefficient. And then they give you, basically, these are two classes of white blood cell groups, which may be linked to autoimmune diseases or immune-mediated diseases. So most breeds are fixed at this location and don't really have a lot of diversity. It's not as common to get that. So sometimes, I have an example, it may be wise to retain a dog that's not ideal or perfect to the standard, but has virtues in itself, but also has a diversity here. That may be something you want to keep and have that in your lines. It'll also show you the inbreeding by the chromosomes. So it's just a fun picture layout of where they're inbred and where they're not. It doesn't really mean anything spectacular, but it's just something that you can see visually how inbred they are, how unrelated that individual is. When we look at disease testings, they can be a false sense of security. If an animal comes up negative for known genetic diseases, this doesn't mean to me breed that animal as possible. It just means that that animal is free of what we know. And we can use those tools to breed with other dogs that we have tested and try to get our particular phenotype and our standard, but also, you know, have genetically healthy dogs. But I would not make that my whole entire line because it can break. Because again, he's negative for what you know, but he's not negative for, or she's not negative for everything that could possibly be there. The risk of developing a new genetic disease could be there, but the risk of developing the ones we know about is low. The situation basically is, who would you say gets to breed? A dog that's clear of all diseases on a microarray, or a dog that's homozygous affected for PRA, but has like striking virtues? They can technically both breed. Because if we breed this affected dog to a normal dog that is negative on both sides for PRA, then we'll have carriers. We won't have any in the litter affected by PRA. Clear on disease and microarray, yeah, we should breed that one too, because that one also is clear on the microarray of all of the diseases we know about for that breed. But that doesn't mean that this disqualifies that this dog breed because he has is an affected. It means that if you breed it to a normal, you'll have carriers. And then you would still retain maybe the other virtues that are there within that dog. To remove an individual, usually there's more than one thing has to be wrong. Mainly the first thing that I look at is, what does the disease do? Does it cause the dog to have significant quality of life issues as it goes on? Or does it lead to early death? Does it cause significant harm where it's, again, suffering? Then, is the disease state known to have signs in the heterozygous state? So meaning that, is it a dominant trait? Because then that may just be debilitating enough to have to remove them. Are enough individuals in the population there to justify removing the individual in question? Because if you have a small breed, then you have to be very prudent about who you're choosing and who you're eliminating. Because who you're eliminating is just as important as who you're keeping. And then, does the individual have genetics that are uncommon to the breed? So this is the part I kind of wanted to get to. So this is kind of what I look for in my kennel. There's no hard numbers, but you know, you want coefficients of inbreeding that are no more than like 5 or 10%, but that's just a calculation. Yeah, I do health testing on breeding individuals early. And usually with my litters, I do the test and then I adopt them out to their owners with their genetic tests and they're happy about that as well. But I also learn from the beginning who I want to kind of, if I'm looking at a dog and they're looking like they're going to be good for my kennel, I also know their genetics early. So if I want to then keep them longer or grow them out, or should I just give them up at that time? Is it worth it for me? You want to work to a larger genomic diversity through time. So you don't have to get to a specific number or goal, but you just want to maybe get slightly better each generation. So you're not so homozygous, but also that you're not so diverse that you're not seeing your traits pop up, you know, again and again. I also accept individuals who are not perfect. Imperfection is okay sometimes because they may have things like one of my dogs, my females, has actually a diversification of that white blood cell group that I talked about, where it's very rare to actually have in a breed. So that dog is not perfect, but that dog has a trait that I want to keep severely. We should also be looking at our fertility. Like I look at my fertility. Are these females that I have producing litters in the 4 to 6 puppy range, or are they doing 2 puppies at a time? Because that's not a line that I necessarily would want to continue unless it was stunning in some way. But if we look at fertility, that also does have to do with genetic diversity. So my sable line comes from a female that had litters of 8 and like 7 to 8. And then most of mine that I have right now come from a litter of 9. Her coefficient of inbreeding, if we look, was 37. There's no diversity in her white blood cell group, but her fertility was phenomenal. So that's a line that I do want to keep. And I want to make sure that I maintain that fertility each generation down because it was there in the beginning. So if I start losing it, then I know something, I'm doing something wrong. And then the progeny, she had a 37% inbreeding coefficient. The 2 females I have from her are 39 and 43. I mean, that's not that high up from 37. I'm okay with that. Again, they have no diversity in their white blood cell group, but they do come from a litter where they are having high rates of puppies, which is something you should look for. And then when I run the SNP panel, it comes up as at risk for MDR1. That's something that affects my breed. Certain drugs will have noticeable side effects. So I know about that and I can just breed her to another non-carrier, normal. And I'm not worried about continuing that, having diseased dogs within my lines because I know what that female is at that site. Then you'll also get on these arrays and these plans where purebred dogs are in general. And then where mixed breeds are, which is always going to be much, much further to the right than our breeds. And then it gives you your breed, where if your median is 30% and your genetic diversity is falling more towards the 15s and 20s, you want to be on the upslope, maybe even on the top of here, then maybe in the first standard deviation is kind of ideal. So sitting there would be best. It's something to work towards. And again, you're not going to get terrible things in here, but it's just something to improve or an improvement goal. Body size in my breed, it counts a lot because we have over or under size issues. So it helps when you have the body size indicators, which are kind of accurate, that you may see these dogs that they're large on all sides. They're going to be large. They're going to be over. It may not be worthwhile to keep that because you may just be making, larger than you would want or out of size dogs. And then again, watching the coefficient of inbreeding or watching different, alleles that we want to keep. And then so one of my more recent ones, again, so now I have odds on the smaller side, the intermediate, the smaller, which I like. Our coefficient of inbreeding is less than before, which is good. Again, I want near 30 because that's the breed average. We don't have diversity here, but that's okay. Another one of mine, the actual calculated inbreeding is 13.51%. So that's a little bit higher, but that's okay. And that does correlate with our array because the 43% of diversity is a little high, or homozygosity is high. And then we do have to watch this one because we have intermediate larger on. So we have puppies that are on the larger side, more difficult to actually keep. again, but our puppies are going to probably be more uniform in what we're looking for in terms of the standard. But we just have to make sure we watch that we're not getting too far away from this and drifting towards even higher coefficients of inbreeding and not getting sized puppies that you want. This is the one that I have that is not as well in the standard. However, the coefficient of inbreeding is 41%, which I'm okay with. But this dog has a high diversity at that site that I was talking about, which is extremely rare. So this is something that I, as a geneticist, I want this. I want to keep this. And I want to have a line with this in it. And so that's the only reason that I'm accepting of some of the, you know, traits that are not within the standard, because I can regain those, but I can't always regain the diversity there. And this is the last one. This is one of my males that I had. You know, we have intermediate, smaller and smaller, which is good because we should have maybe more predictability in size, which is what I look for and where I have a problem with. You know, we're looking at our coefficient of inbreeding, which is 44. That's fine. We mate him with females that may be a little bit more diverse because he makes pretty uniform puppies that are the same. And we can always work away from that. But this is like a very moderate, pretty acceptable means of a male that you would want. And then, you know, he is tested for all of these diseases. So I have that because, we, you know, he is a male, so other people may use him. I want to get as much information as I can behind that so other people may, or those that want to use them. And then I can provide them that information. So that's how I keep my kennel. I kind of wanted to now like keep a little bit of more time for question and answers because I feel like that's kind of where people want or want to understand what they should be doing.
Great. We have a bunch of questions. I saw one that came in that I wanted to make sure we asked. This is from Richard, who said, you mentioned that outcrossing means using dogs that are completely unrelated. In a small population, if we go back enough generations, there will always be common ancestors. How many generations are required to differentiate between inbreeding and outcrossing in a small population breed?
So it's hard to say that. I mean, I can't say as many generations back, you know, because yes, they will all be related, but as the breed grows, there should be new genes or like mixing of genes that happen. So I would say maybe as long as there are maybe three generations back as unrelated, that that's something that's helpful. But even that sometimes in certain breeds is not even something you can go by. So using the actual like arrays and looking at their overall variance is helpful because then you can choose the most varied ones that still retain the standard and kind of move forward from there.
Great. And we had another question. Someone was wondering if you could share what you think are the earliest warning signs that a line or a whole breed is losing diversity before it shows up as health problems, or does that not show up until health problems really become apparent?
So the health problems become apparent by themselves, but something that the breed is not doing well is litter sizes. So I would say reproductive, because reproduction is a luxury. So it's not something that the body will prioritize should something be going on. So reproduction is a luxury. So if litter size is falling and fertility is falling in general across the breed, that's a problem. Like that's kind of something that will raise a red flag that maybe something is going on.
And I think this comes up a lot with breeders in general, the popular sire effect, where breeders are finding these like very exceptional studs. So how do you weigh using a really exceptional, widely used stud against the longer term cost to a breed's diversity?
Well, you shouldn't have 100% of your lines related to him then, right? You should have like different little mini populations in your kennel, like you should have three maybe established lines that are not unrelated. They're always going to be somewhat related, but they're bred a little bit differently than you would, you know, you wouldn't really mix too much with them because then you had like 30%, 30%, 30%. Let's say one third fails or is failing, then you at least have the two thirds to go back to that you didn't really use that sire too much with. So you're not infiltrating your kennel wholly with one dog.
Got it. We had a bunch of questions about health testing, and I really like this one. Someone asked, with so many DNA panels available now, how do you prioritize which tests actually matter for a given breed versus testing for everything? I think testing as a whole can just feel like a little bit intimidating to breeders and they don't know where to start. So I'm curious if you could share how you prioritize which tests actually matter versus tests that just test for everything.
So when you do the array, it's going to test for everything, and then it's going to report weird diseases that are not known to be in your breed. Those, unless other people are finding that they're having problems, I would ignore. So let's say one of my dogs is positive for a degenerative myelopathy gene. That's not something we see in Shelties in general. It's often a disease of the larger breed dog anyway. So that is not something that I'm looking at. But if my dogs come up positive for or have a high risk of dermatomyositis, which is a disease that's highly debilitating in my breed, like that's something that I really care about. So it's looking at like the percentile of diseases that are affecting the breed versus the ones that are maybe in the background that may be like that, not a disease, but that may be just a variant in a gene that's not related to which is disease because it's not statistically high enough to be causing or likely to be a problem. But if other kennels are saying that they see something like that, then it becomes something you should be testing for. But if it's just like a blip and there's just one individual that you see comes up with that, or there's another individual that comes with a couple that you, that doesn't even pertain to your breed, that's not something that I would be really looking at too much because that's probably some sort of just genomic variation that's like showing up at that site, but not necessarily mm-hmm. a disease.
Thank you for answering that one. I think we have time for just two more. So this one was about selection pressure. Someone was curious, are there traits breeders commonly over-select for that ends up hurting the line down the road?
So unfortunately, that would be the brachycephalic breeds, the dog breeds that have had the skull reduced in size, because the problem is not that the skull reduced in size, it's that the skull reduced in size, but the tissue inside the head has not come down to the same size that the head came down to. They just didn't match. Like in small breed dogs, there's a lot of dentition issues because the teeth touch, because the teeth did not as rapidly reduce in the size with the dog. So if you select too hard for anatomic variations, you don't always know what is not actually following your visual schematic. Like the soft palate in these brachycephalic dogs are the size of the palate they would have if they otherwise had a normal type head. So the selection pressure is selecting for those extremes that we may not know what's actually happening underneath until we are seeing stuff medically or things are having to be intervened with. And it just didn't happen to come together as you exactly mm-hmm. wanted it to.
Amazing. Thank you for answering that. We like to typically end these presentations with a forward thinking question. And I feel like this is one of the best kinds of presentations to do that for. So if a breeder is thinking two or three generations ahead, what should a breeder be doing now that pays off later?
So what you should be doing now that pays off later is and diversifying your lines, having not just one set of dogs, having like three sets of lines that you have, if you can, so that, again, if one starts to have lower litter sizes or starts to fail and you have to start working and patching that one up, you still have two lines that are going that you're actively not choosing the same dogs for. You're choosing slightly different dogs for those. They're not all related. They're going to be related, like I said, but there's just like that slight, you know, variation of unrelationship between them. So that, again, like should failure happen in one third, then you do have a large population that you can still go from, or you can rehabilitate that line possibly with using or mixing in one of the other lines you have down the line because you kind of built in a failsafe.
Great. Thank you for answering that. I think that was all of the questions we have time for. Thank you for such an amazing presentation and for your time. We're so appreciative of it, Dr. Stora.
No problem.
Amazing. And thank you to our community, of course, for joining us today. If you're not yet a member of our community, we would love to have you join us. You can apply and learn more at gooddog.com/join. So you can stay up to date on all of our future events as well. And just looking ahead to our next event, I'll leave everyone with a preview of our next webinar, which will be on August 26th at 1 p.m. Eastern. And it's going to be with Dr. Andrea Hesser, all about planning an elective C-section, something we've been getting a lot of requests to cover. So we're excited to have her join us for that. We'll be getting the registration link up for that later this week. So we hope to see you all there. And until then, I hope everyone has a great rest of their day. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.